You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
I got free!
I got free!
When a wave of citizen-led uprisings swept the planet last summer, the Black Lives Matter movement forced a moment of reckoning at some of our most respected international institutions. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres publicly supported the protests, then prohibited his staff from attending them. There was outrage, and Guterres quickly backtracked. Meanwhile, 1,000 current and former staffers accused Doctors Without Borders of embracing a mindset of white supremacy. Employees of the U.S. Agency for International Development accused the agency of systematic racism. The world of international aid had been put on notice. This week, we're looking at international aid, what works, what doesn't, and how it could be reinvented. Since long before it was fashionable, Dagan Ali has been talking about a legacy of colonialism buried deep within the international foreign aid system.
So I grew up in the U.S. That's why I have this American accent.
The daughter of a Somali politician who moved the family to Washington, D.C. when she was a child, Dagan returned to Somalia in 1999 as an employee of the United Nations.
And when I came into the sector, I was very naive and very hopeful, very idealistic, thinking that, you know, the work that we were doing was amazing and, you know, that it was very easy to penetrate the system. It was very easy to do the right thing, to do good quality programs, to do what the communities needed. I guess, in addition to experiencing a lot of racism trying to get a job in the sector, and always being treated like a national staff, even though I had the same education as many foreign actors in the space. I had American education, American university, a British university for my master's. I was always told I would be hired as a national and not as an expatriate. And there's different salary scales. And so this is part of the racism in the system, is this pay scale and how it favors and opens doors very easily for expatriates, for these third country nationals to get these positions. Whereas if you are a national of that country, to get a job on an equal basis as those other third country nationals is very difficult. They will always treat you differently. And they might hire you if you have the skills for a particular position, but they want you to get the national salary instead of the international salary. If you are a local organization funded by that international NGO, they almost always ensure that you're not fully funded. They don't fund your overheads. They don't fund your executive director position, your office, and all of these things. And they try to ensure that you are never at the same level. So they've gotten $1 million from USAID for a project, but they'll give you 200,000 of that million. And they'll tell you to have the same level of impact for that 200,000. And in that process, of course, you're paying your own staff and a local organization far less.
But Dagan says there was a pivotal moment when she realized, in her words, how warped the system was.
And since there is no food and there is no water in their area, that's why they...
If the rains don't come, we're going to have up to 1 million people who are going to be affected.
It was 2003. There was a severe drought in Somalia, and her organization proposed a cash transfer system for the nomadic communities most affected.
Our staff understood that these pastoral communities needed cash injection in the local economy because of the high debt rate. They had taken on so much debt that normally pastoralists take debt during the dry seasons and pay back during the wet season. And the wet season wasn't coming. And the local economy was impacted. And this was having an effect on this whole supply chain up to the big cities. So that understanding of the local economy is something that we had as a local organization. So we suggested cash. So can you imagine going to a meeting with mostly white people? You're one of the few Somalis in the room and you suggest cash transfers. We had such, I mean, shockingly negative reaction. Oh, people will spend cash on drugs. They'll spend cash on guns because this is a post-conflict country. They won't spend the cash on feeding their children, their families. So this idea that poor people, Black people, Somalis could not make, you know, decisions, good decisions, take responsibility to make decisions on what their people needed, what their children needed, what their family needed, was shocking to me, that they could not let go of control, that they couldn't let go of power, and how the idea of cash really was such a threat to the existing structure of WFP and big INGOs who are moving food aid for USAID and European donors. So that was a real shock to me, that the cash made sense. It was dignified. It would have excellent impact in the local economy. It would have a ripple effect in so many ways. It will allow people to have the choice to make their decisions. So many things that are positive for it. But at the same time, the reaction was extremely negative. That was the first event where I realized people are not making decisions on what's good for the people, what communities really need, but they're making decisions based on their own business interest.
Today, Dagan Ali is director of the Nairobi-based nonprofit Adesso. Her calls for an overhaul of the foreign aid system are being heard. We spoke over Zoom last month, and we were joined by someone else who knows the international aid system all too well. Eileen O'Connor is senior vice president of the Rockefeller Foundation, which has distributed $17 billion in aid globally. Previously, she worked in the Obama administration's State Department. She oversaw hundreds of millions of dollars in public diplomacy budgets in 15 countries, including Afghanistan and Pakistan, where she was based for a time. Eileen O'Connor, you worked for the U.S. government, which obviously is a major grant-making organization, and in South Asia, where there were tremendous transfers of aid over the years. Now you work for a major grant-making organization. Does that ring true with what you've seen over the years, what you just heard Dagan talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, because when I was in Afghanistan, I had a $200 million public diplomacy budget, and we were doing what we called public diplomacy on steroids under Richard Holbrooke, who was saying, look, this is to help build, you know, help with democracy, help civil society, et cetera. And of course, there was also programs under USAID and international relief organizations, UNAMA, et cetera. But we were the only ones where when I came in, we said, look, you know, it's the local Afghan people who really know what they need to build their version of you know, a government, a democratic government, their own self-rule, what they would want in terms of their government, in terms of their legal structures, et cetera. And also in terms of what they found in independent media. So one of the things we really focused on was grant making to Afghan organizations. And one of the big complaints I got from Washington was, oh, well, they won't know how to manage that money. And they don't really know how to write those grants. And they don't really understand how we need to account for that money, because you're going to have to account for that in Congress. Are you willing to go up to Capitol Hill and testify before Congress that all of that money was well spent? And I said, yes, because what we can do is go, they will do a much better job. They will spend more money on the program versus on things like, as Dagan said, salaries or overhead or security was a huge issue in Afghanistan. But for local Afghans, it was not as big an issue. And so one of the things we found, and we measured things, but we did a couple of things. We worked with the local Afghan organizations to help them, to help with trainings. We went all over the country and trained local organizations on how to manage big amounts of money. It was true, there was not, they didn't manage it in the same way or didn't understand how to account for it in the same way that we needed in terms of governance for congressional verification. But that's not brain surgery. And so we were able to just train them how to do that. And then we also measured impact. And we found that with a lot of the other aid that was going, it was 40 to 50 cents, maybe 60 cents on the dollar going to the program. But by going to Afghan organizations, we were getting 80 to 90 cents of on the dollar going directly to the program, to the people on the ground. We also understood that those organizations culturally, they really understood what people needed. So we could spend far less money and have bigger impacts. I'll give you one example. There was a program, we were trying to get mobile phones into people's hands because, you know, mobile phone technology can do a couple of things. It can, as Deegan was saying, you know, cash transfers. If you can get it through mobile banking, it bypasses potentially corrupt systems that might take that money or skim off the top that money that really should be going to the farmers, et cetera, and the people on the ground. So we wanted to get that. We also wanted to be able to do education through that or help people with their own market sense and market knowledge through mobile phones. So we needed to build cell phone towers. But one of the biggest problems was Taliban would often try to destroy these cell phone towers because they were also used by the military to track the Taliban and insurgents. And so they would threaten people, et cetera. But when we went to the local communities and said, look, we want to build a cell phone tower through, by the way, an Afghan organization that we found that could build these cell phone towers, we were able to build, the local community said, we'll protect that cell phone tower because we want it for these various reasons. And we ended up building a whole series of cell phone towers across, connecting east to west Afghanistan for less money than the military took to build one cell phone tower in Kandahar, which ended up being useless because they built it next to a mountain. And if you know anything about cell phone towers, building it next to a mountain isn't going to be super effective because the mountain blocks the signal. So I think, you know, it just goes to Dagan's point that this, you know, by talking to the local communities, they really understand what's needed, what will work, and they also are much more efficient in building those things.
Dagan Ali, there's an interesting thread in both your stories, and I want to hear from both of you on it. I'm not naive. I know corruption exists, and it's something you have to look out for. But when I've covered international aid, it seems the fear of corruption is so exaggerated that it calcifies, it ossifies any effort to get money out into communities. Big donors are so defensive about corruption that they spend more money trying to build in protections against it. And it reeks of condescension. It reeks of paternalism. To give an example, in Haiti, they spent so much money trying not to have money go to the wrong places that for a long time, very little money went anywhere because they were so spun up about the possibility that an untoward dollar might end up in the wrong hands. When you watch that going on, Dagan Ali, can you assess that apart from race and colonialism? Or is that just shot through those attitudes? These people are profligate. They'll waste it. They'll skim it. They'll steal it. I'm sure you've heard this before.
I think there is an element of racism in that narrative. I don't think we can get away from that. But I also think there's this element of control and also dishonesty about we need to face the reality that our desire to keep control and to prevent corruption is actually creating more inefficiencies in the system and costing more money than allowing and accepting a percentage of mismanagement. Yeah? If we are honest and say 10%, 20% might be mismanaged, but 80, 90% will get into the communities, as opposed to the current structure where you have a dollar that goes from USAID, that goes to a UN agency, who then gives it to an INGO, who then gives it to a sister member of their INGO, who gives it to a country office of that INGO, who then gives it to a local NGO, who then gives it to the community. Do you understand how many layers of intermediation that's taking place? And each layer, there's a cost associated with it. I'm shocked that, you know, that there's this, that Eileen is talking about 40 to 50%. I've heard most donors won't even admit that percentage. I've counted for the food aid when we were doing the comparison between cash transfers and food aid. I suspect that only 20% of the food aid budgets was actually going into the hands of communities. And then what would happen? We would give food from Iowa, grains that was not culturally appropriate, and then people would sell it or give it to their livestock. So they would monetize it, or they would give it to their livestock and not feed it for them, for themselves, not eat it for themselves. So not only are we doing bad programming that's not appropriate because we're using the wrong intermediation, people who don't understand the context, but we are doing it very inefficiently and actually creating legalized corruption mechanisms when all of these layers of intermediation are actually taking a huge chunk of the funding. So I would actually say that we need to have a very honest conversation with taxpayers. And another thing is not just educating the taxpayer and letting them understand what's happening, but the reality is that most of the corruption I have personally experienced in my 20 plus years has been from international agencies, not from locals. But that's a hidden narrative, because there is a complicity that takes place between the donor and that international agency. My first experience with a bribe happened not from a local NGO or a government staff. It happened from a UN staff member. Yeah, that was my first experience. And one of the things I always tell donors, that if you're giving 60, 70% of your aid budget to the international actors, the volume of corruption is actually higher with that aid organization. You know how much local organizations get in the humanitarian funding? 0.2%. So what is the chances of corruption taking place? It's a very minuscule amount that will actually end up being corrupt, directed by local organizations. When you are giving the bulk of the money, 60% to the UN, another 20 to 40% to the INGOs and contractors, very little of your money is going directly to local organizations. So this idea that majority of it is at risk of being corruption is actually not correct. The majority that is at risk of being corrupted is being managed by international actors who have massive incidents of corruption. We've seen what happened in Syria. We have heard cases, massive billion-dollar cases of corruption in Afghanistan and Iraq from U.S. government funding. But what happens to those organizations? They're protected. They are protected. Those incidents are covered up. Whereas a local organization has one incident, mismanagement, maybe it's one staff, maybe it's not endemic within that organization, just one incident. Not only does that organization cease to exist, it's completely blacklisted, but it affects all local organizations in that country. All donors now stop funding local organizations. Whereas the opposite happens with internationals. I've heard a donor say to me publicly, we know what this happened, but just keep it out of the press. Just keep it out of the New York Times. That's their biggest fear, that it's going to be a big issue in that goes back to the taxpayers, and then it becomes a big hoopla, and then Congress. I understand that pressure, that, you know, they hear about a scandal and then Congress takes away the aid funding and all of that. But who is it happening by? These are happening by internationals. All of these big incidents, the safeguarding incidents, it's not happening by local organizations. So let's just be honest and have a real conversation about this idea of corruption.
I completely agree. And I think there's another aspect to corruption, which of these big contractors get the money to dole out or to implement development projects. And I mean, Ray, you know, as a former journalist, as journalists, we all know the adage, follow the money. Well, follow the money back to campaign contributions by some of these big contractors. And I think you'll find that, you know, is that a form of corruption? Because that is actually dictating what we spend our development dollars on at times. There have been mandates to USAID, and USAID officials have complained to me over the years that they are sometimes mandated to spend X percentage on, say, water projects, or Y percentage on this project. And when really that's not what's needed on the ground. What's needed is something different, but their hands are tied. And so, and even as to whom they should be using for those projects. So I think that's another big problem that we don't talk about. And I do believe, you know, in Afghanistan, we had Inspector General John Sopko, who would constantly criticize the mismanagement of the money, mostly in the fact of what did it achieve the impact that it was gearing up to achieve, and how much money we were spending, say, per school we were building, et cetera, et cetera. Legitimate questions, legitimate issues. The problem is his solution was don't spend the money at all. The solution I would suggest is that money could be spent at the local level, a lot less money, much more efficiently. And I think the other issue I would raise that I think Dagan has raised in a lot of her op-eds and her writings and her speaking before is, you know, this need for localization is critically important, but it's not through the big contractors. It doesn't mean sub-granting, because I think what she's just pointed out is the problem with the sub-granting is by the time it gets to the local grantee, most of the money has been taken away through intermediaries through the sub-granting process. So I do believe that there needs to be different rethinking of global development aid in general. And the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, we do try to give money or help local organizations create, you know, more capacity or be the main driver. But I think we still need to do a lot more. We're actually doing a huge study of our grant making, and we've been criticized legitimately by some food organizations for depending too much on sort of white-led, white-owned international organizations versus really on-the-ground local organizations. And we are changing that, I think. And I think that's the right thing to do. But it's not like we don't have more work to do as well.
We're going to take a short break, but we'll return to my conversation with Dagan Ali and Eileen O'Connor in just a moment. You're listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Ray Suarez. If you want to hear more of our stories from around the world, you can check out our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also like to tell you about a new podcast we're listening to. Empowering Women in the Workplace is one of the simplest ways to boost the global economy. But from India to Uganda, women are getting left behind. Find out why in The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. It's a new limited series podcast from Foreign Policy. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's return to my conversation about reinventing international aid with Dagan Ali and Eileen O'Connor. Well, over the past year, certainly, but really for more than 10 years in the United States, there's been a major social and cultural upheaval, an attempt at a reckoning with the place of race in our history, the way we think about it, the way we talk about it, the way we acknowledge it, and frankly, the way we deny its place, spurred by activists and the Black Lives Matter movement. Race and the legacy of colonialism in international aid, Dagan Ali, is a subject that you've spoken extensively about for decades, using the platform that you have to offer critiques of the way the business works. And you've done that even at personal and political cost. And you've mentioned being blacklisted. Does this latest Black Lives Matter moment send vibrations not only in recipient world, but in grant-making world, not only in the Horn of Africa, but in Geneva and Brussels and Washington as well?
Yeah, there has been a massive change. In 2019, I had an interview with DevEx, and I talked about my experience with racism in the aid sector. My personal experience, I didn't name names of individuals or organizations in Somalia, And that was received very negatively by white male donors in Somalia, to the point where I was blacklisted and our organization was blacklisted. And then in less than a year, everything has flipped now as a result of the whole Black Lives Matter movement. What was before a taboo, talking about racism, me using the word racism in a conference, in an event, in a public event, in the humanitarian or development space, was considered like the entire room would go quiet. It was just such a, it would be that awkward, really long silence that happens. And but now everybody is talking about it. So in a way, I feel empowered that I can now finally speak the truth that needs to be talked about. We can finally have an honest conversation that's long overdue about these issues. So for me, it's relieved some stress, some personal stress for me in having these conversations. As a Black woman in this space, it's really painful and difficult to constantly be the only one of the few lone voices, you know, speaking truth to power and risking your organization and your funding and all of these things. So for that alone, the Black Lives Matter movement and the moment we're in has been amazing for me. I would like to turn it into more than just rhetoric. I would like to turn it into real practical change, because we have talked enough. This is not a new issue. We have been talking about decolonizing development, decolonizing aid. We have been talking about the racism in this space for a long time. And we haven't been using the words racism, but we have talked about these issues of proximate leadership and working through local organization and community-led development and all of these great things, but we're not doing it. And so I think we need to really do an honest autopsy of why we are not doing it and what are the incentives that currently exist for not doing these things, not doing the right thing. And we don't have those incentives built in the system right now. The donors don't have it. The philanthropists don't have it. The USAIDs and the DFIDs don't have it. And we need to change that incentive structure. And so I would like to turn this to moment, not of rhetoric, but real action and real change. And I'm still waiting for that change, but I'm hopeful that it will happen.
Are those same vibrations, those same impulses being felt, Eileen, in your world? Is there a feeling that the sand has shifted underneath everybody's feet and just going and continuing to do this things the same way we did them 5 years ago just isn't going to be okay anymore?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, it's not just the Black Lives Matter movement. It's COVID. It's this pandemic that has shown us that, you know, we have failed in really development. While millions moved out of extreme poverty in the last few decades, millions moved back into extreme poverty just in this past year. I mean, as of April 2021, for example, the World Food Program estimated 296 million people in 35 countries where it works are without sufficient food. Now, that's 111 million more people than in April just 1 year ago in 2020. So if you look at it, Ray, and you know, it is basically, we're clearly not doing the right thing. So we clearly shouldn't be doing the same thing. And we're clearly measuring the wrong things. When we think about development, we're measuring things like GDP. We're imposing systems that we think are the right systems, the right measurements, the right things. But as Dagan says, That's a colonial sort of mapping. That's a colonial kind of viewpoint. And we need to be looking at human security as what does it take for every single person to have opportunity, to have access to food, to nourishing food, by the way, not just any food, to have access to healthcare, to electricity, and to the ability to promote, to have a job, to actually have economic activity. And that doesn't necessarily mean copying the systems in the donor countries. It means being, you know, listening to the people on the ground, understanding what they think the solutions are and what they know the solutions are, and assisting them and partnering with them to find those solutions. But I think you've got to look at the growing inequity over the last 40 years that our own country and the world is seeing. And it is unsustainable. And it's also leading to, you know, such death and economic destruction for so many communities through this pandemic. And it will be only made worse if we don't address it with in the face of this existential threat of climate change. So we've got to do something different, or else we're just going to keep digging a deeper hole.
There were Black Lives Matter demonstrations all across the United States. They were seen on TV all around the world, but there were also mirror demos in places like Bristol and London and Paris and Cape Town and Durban. The world was watching. And Degan Ali, I'm wondering if that makes a difference. Does it press on the people who are the keepers of the rules of the game to create this feeling that the rules of the game have to change?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's a global moment. And I think that goes back to what Eileen was saying, that it's linked also to the pandemic. Because, you know, having a lockdown in Europe or the US is extremely different than having a lockdown in Kenya. I live right next to one of the largest slums in Africa, in Kibera. And having a lockdown has just decimated and devastated people's livelihoods here, you know, and people that I've known for 10, 20 years who were, you know, working as a massage or this or that, you know, just, you know, blue collar jobs and just labor jobs, for the first time were contacting me and asking me for help to pay their rent, to asking me for help to pay school fees, or asking me help for this and that. I've never been in the position of giving these people charity because, you know, they worked. But these people were now put in a position where they couldn't work. So they said to me in the beginning of the lockdown, you know, coronavirus might kill us, but we know that hunger will kill us for sure. And so I think this the global moment is a reflection of that realization that, you know, the inequities that Eileen talked about that have been piling up. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back is COVID. So the thing for me is, when I talk about decolonization, it's not only how aid manifests itself at the ground level, at the operational level, and how programs are implemented and the things I've already described, but it's also looking at the larger global governance system. This is by design. This is not by happenstance. This is as a result of the post-colonial structures that were created, like the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF, the World Banks, the World Trade Organizations, the UN veto power. All of these institutions have been established, and the rules of the game have been established to ensure that former colonies stay in poverty and the former colonizers continue their economic and political hegemony. So that's the reality. This is not poverty by accident, but poverty by design. So we need to understand that decolonization is not a manifestation of just addressing this issue of diversifying your staff and your leadership and creating pay equity in you know, this issue between international salary scale and local salary scale, but looking at the entire design of the global architecture of the global governance systems that were designed in Bretton Woods. So we have to really create a level playing field for these countries in the global South so that they can develop on their own terms, on their own, with serious food, with food sovereignty, have food subsidies in place to support their citizens. Things that the Europe and US has for their farmers, they're denied in the South as part of the World Bank and IMF loans. They were told you can no longer have your food subsidies for your farmers. So what happens? A drought happens in Malawi, and then the same donors who are behind and controlling the power, the votes of the World Bank that made these rules to get them to destroy their food subsidies are the ones who now give funding to an NGO or UNICEF to run a nutrition program when that drought happens and a hunger crisis happens in Malawi. So we are complicit, and all we're doing is creating we're just responding, and this is band-aid solutions. We're not addressing the root causes that developed the hunger crisis in Malawi. Why were those food subsidies removed? Why were the reserves removed? Why can't Malawi get a level playing field in its trade policies? Why can't Africa not be a source of extractive of raw materials, but be a source of production? You cannot lift millions and billions of people out of poverty like China did without industrialization, but we're not given that opportunity to industrialize. We need to become a source of tires, not just a source of rubber. We need to become a source of chocolate that is exported, not a source of cocoa. But we are always a source of raw materials, and this is by design, and that is what's keeping us in poverty.
I would agree. I mean, the problem too is that even now in the system of assistance. I mean, we just did a global vaccination plan. And because part of that is, you know, 80% of the vaccines have been in high and upper middle income countries. And while nearly 50% of North Americans have been vaccinated, only 2% of Africans have been vaccinated. And why is that? Well, that's because the capacity to build and manufacture vaccines mostly exists in high and middle income countries. Why? Because of patent protections, because of trade protections. And there has been attempts in the past by global public health organizations, some of those people are actually now on the staff at Rockefeller and trying to do it again, we need to be able to transfer technology and enable manufacturing capacity in the global south, so that, as Dakin said, you know, people can make not just extract industries, but can also make things like diagnostic tests, vaccines, and other things that will actually protect the world from a future pandemic. But by the way, that technology will also enable them to be able to develop and to build even other therapeutic remedies for other disease, and will actually reduce disease globally. I think the problem is that we have to understand that no one is safe until everyone is safe, and that this inequity and the way that we're, you know, basically dealing with a protectionist structure is actually dangerous. It's not protecting anyone. It's actually increasing the divergence, economic divergence and social divergence around the world, which is causing huge instability and is actually causing the kind of migration that people in the United States are so afraid of. And so if that's the case, then we need to rethink how things happen. I would also point out that we too at the Rockefeller Foundation are looking at how do we really think through a restructuring of the Bretton Woods system. I absolutely agree that it is an antiquated system that is not working right now.
A couple of years ago, Zambian born and raised, American educated, Dambisa Moyo made a big splash with a book that basically said, all that aid makes beggars out of these countries. It's not only paternalist, it's ineffective. It creates sort of global welfare mentality. Just blow it up. As I listen to both of you talk about the structural inequities, the mistaken approaches, the inbuilt condescension in a lot of what goes on, I wonder if I'm not hearing vibrations of Dambisa Moyo in what you have to say, whether we should just blow it up, start from scratch, end what we're doing, and try to figure out a better way to do this.
I would like to not blow it up, if possible. I would like to see that we can take a different direction in the road. I would like to reinvent the Bretton Woods institutions and have a serious conversation, an honest conversation, and just fair negotiation, and just negotiations, realizing the history, the wealth extraction that has happened with the Global South and allows them to start developing in a level playing field. So I think, you know, addressing the macro level issues with the Bretton Woods institutions, giving direct budget support from the US government to the national governments and their development plans, but at the same time, investing in strong civil society, I think that is the best road ahead in terms of what the US government can do.
Eileen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is we think of this as aid and somehow like that we're helping or saving. And really, it's an investment. And we don't talk about the money that we send to states for road building or for other social safety net programs as aid. We see it as an investment. And so we should think of assistance as an investment. You know, when we build infrastructure throughout Africa, or when those countries build their own infrastructure, build manufacturing capacity, build distribution systems, renewable energy grids, that's not just helping their countries, it's helping the global populations, because we're not taking into account the true cost of leaving people behind. It shouldn't be about, you know, the aid itself. It should be about how we give it, how we account for its impact, and the structures in which we use to measure success or not.
That's Eileen O'Connor. She's Senior Vice President of the Rockefeller Foundation. Previously, she served as an official in the Obama administration, overseeing hundreds of millions of dollars in public diplomacy budgets in 15 countries. And Dagan Ali is the director of the Nairobi-based nonprofit Adesso, which focuses on changing the way people think about and deliver aid.